You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. When a populist wave swept Donald Trump into the White House in 2016, the media's favorite adjective of the moment became unprecedented. But in fact, America's political history is peppered with a long list of populist leaders, some of whom even made it to the presidency, and more than a few whose brief moment in the sun ended in defeat, public disgrace, and even assassination. American populism has always been home to a fascinating assortment of charismatic leaders, characters, kooks, cranks, and sometimes charlatans, who have, with widely varying degrees of success, led the charge of ordinary folks who've gotten wise to the ways of the swamp. Let's face it, we're a sucker for a fellow who'll tell us whatever we want to hear, and as my guest today points out, there is something absolutely American about the notion that you, my friends, are getting screwed. He's Fox News politics editor Chris Steirwalt, and he's written a fun and lively account of America's populist tradition called Every Man a King, a short, colorful history of American populists. Today, Chris joins me on the podcast to discuss where populists and populist movements come from, how economic resentment fuels populism even in times of huge prosperity, and why the will of the people doesn't always make for great policy. He discusses why populist leaders are so prone to hucksterism and easy answers, including one politician who literally started out as a snake oil salesman and ended up inspiring a classic American novel, and why it's a good thing that he and most other populist leaders never actually had to govern. He talks about the least likely populist, President Teddy Roosevelt, why his progressive Bull Moose Party quickly fizzled after the election of 1912, but how it had a dramatic impact on the Republican Party for over a century. He describes how George Wallace shifted the focus from economic populism to cultural populism, why he says Pat Buchanan is the grandfather of Trumpism, and how that kook with a crew cut, Ross Perot, invented the trope of the businessman who can fix Washington. Plus, the time America flirted with electing a self-professed socialist and radical, and I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders, folks, why the election of 1864 gives Chris hope, and he suggests that modern-day populists might want to aspire to be the Andrew Jackson of Hispanic America. Coming up with Chris Steirwalt in just a moment. Chris Steirwalt is the politics editor at Fox News, where he authors the daily Fox News Halftime Report and co-hosts the hit podcast Perino and Steirwalt, I'll Tell You What. He's written a new book called Every Man a King, a short, colorful history of American populists. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Now, the title is a reference to a pledge made by the Louisiana populist Huey Long, and he's just one of seven American populists you discuss in Every Man a King. And I love the opening line to this book. You say, there is something absolutely American about the notion that you, my friends, are getting screwed royally. Now, that's not good, is it? Does populism just boil down to grievance politics?
What's the Woody Allen joke? Even paranoiacs have enemies. Some grievances are real.
Yeah.
You know, the grievances that Andrew Jackson carried forth on behalf of the Scots-Irish immigrants and their descendants who were filling up the interior of the country in the booming start of the 19th century. For those people, they had grievances. Mm-hmm. Against an Eastern elite that shut them out. And so, yeah, did the farmers who supported William Jennings Bryan have grievances against New York, Philadelphia, and the economic centers of the East that profited by tariffs and left them to wither like winter wheat out in the prairie? Sure. You know, to me, populism is about when the burr under the saddle gets to itching so bad that revolt breaks out. When you have any group of people, you know, in our current moment, we have populist leaders on both sides, on all sides, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, people who are leading, they say, we're leading a revolt. We are storming the parapet. We are coming in, and you people who have controlled the levers of power, we're going to take you on. We're going to take you out.
Yeah, and I think that you say that populism usually gets traction when there's an imbalance between freedom and order in society.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, government rightly understood is to find that equipoise between freedom and order. That we need enough. It was C.S. Lewis who, I think it was the Four Loves, but he talks about what's the purpose of government, what's the rightful purpose of a government. And he says a man and his wife sitting and talking by the fire, a man reading a book alone in his room, a man working in his garden by himself. These are the small things. These are the purpose of government is to allow for those things. If you live in Russia, you don't get you not even with your wife alone do you say what you want all the time. If you live in China, you certainly don't read what you want all the time. But if you live in Somalia, you don't work in your garden la-di-da by yourself on a pleasant Sunday afternoon because there is no garden. And if there was one, there'd be RPG rounds going overhead. So rightful government is to protect your freedoms, but also to maintain enough order so that your freedoms can be preserved.
Now, you bring up an interesting paradox to populism in this book because there's always some strong economic resentment behind these movements, and apparently that happens even when the economy has been healthy. And we sort of see that right now because we have the president of the United States telling people the economy's doing gangbusters, yet his supporters, although they don't blame him for this, still complain that they're not getting a fair shake. Whatever happened to a rising tide lifts all ships here?
Well, there's more to life than money.
Yeah.
You know, when we look at George Wallace— the economy in 1968 was not the issue, right? We were still in 1968 at that point, what had been the longest single period of economic expansion. Wages had risen. The rising tide was lifting a lot of boats. But what were people angry about? They were angry about busing. In the South, they had been angry about integration. But in the North, they were angry about busing. They were angry about culture wars. They were angry about hippies and, as he called them, women's libbers and pinkos. And cultural grievance. And while there is a strong economic component to what Trump ended up running as, and what, if we recall at the end of the 2016 election, right when he was at his lowest nadir, it was post-tape, post-disaster. He had slid back down to the 30s, low 40s. He looked doomed. And he became willing to essentially run as a conventional Republican. Newt Gingrich and some guys got a hold of him by the lapels and said, sign this. This is your economic platform. Say this about these judges. And he did. And he shored up support among traditional Republicans in the suburbs. But the core of Donald Trump's candidacy wasn't about economic grievance. It was about cultural grievance. It was about immigrants are changing our culture. You're not allowed to say Merry Christmas anymore. All of those things, his supporters see him as their champion against a dominant culture, that they see a dominant culture in which their ways are being rejected and stepped on and taken down, and they're being supplanted by this new liberal order, Hollywood and New York, and Donald Trump is their pugilist in the ring. So it doesn't always have to be economic.
George Wallace is one of the populists you cover in this book. He was kind of the father of this shift from economic populism to fighting cultural change. So is it fair to say that it was about more than just campaigning against segregation and being a racist? There was also a broader sentiment that he was tapping into at the time.
What I found so fascinating about Wallace, and I had never known this before. So Wallace was in Alabama politics, seen as a moderate on race when he ran for governor the first time in 1958.
Really?
As a judge, he had a reputation as being decent and fair to African-American attorneys, to be with defendants, criminal defendants, not heaping on extra harsh sentences for black defendants, as was the want of most judges in those days, certainly politically aspirant judges in those days. And he was even on the board at the Tuskegee Institute. So he was considered moderate by Alabama standards. But then he runs for governor and gets crushed. And he gets crushed by an out-and-out bigot segregationist scumbag. A total hate monger beats him. And he learns. And, you know, what you see again and again with these populist leaders, when is it about the movement? When is it about them? Wallace figures out, and there's a very dark quote that he recounted to a biographer. He ran the first time as a Huey Long or William Jennings Bryan style progressive populist. Share the wealth, take it from the rich people, give it to the poor people. We need better roads. We need to do all these things. So he was definitely running a populist campaign, but it wasn't racist. It wasn't expressly racist.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I tried to talk about schools, I tried to talk about roads, I tried to talk about all the things I want, but then when I said blank, and he said the word, obviously, they pounded the floor for me. And he realized that the way to power was to be a demagogue and to exploit hate and to exploit division and exploit fear. And he turned the corner from that, and it's what's fascinating to me is so too did a lot of populism in America.
Yeah.
And it shifted this energy. The culture of resentment shifted from economic resentment, not everywhere. Bernie Sanders is still with us today. But this emergence of this right-wing populism focused on cultural grievance.
You were just talking about how George Wallace kind of stumbled on to this political hot button issue that he could campaign on. And I wonder, because that seems to be common among many populist politicians in America, they tend to be painted as kind of hucksters. They'll say whatever you want to hear, and it doesn't matter if they'll deliver in the end. Does that hold true across most of these seven men that you talk about in this book?
Well, a lot of them were lucky that they didn't have to govern or do anything.
Right.
seriously, you know, Andrew Jackson got over the fence. He made it. He won. I won't say stole an election from him, but they pretty near did. Henry Clay, the Electoral College was indecisive, and it was thrown to the House, and Henry Clay gave the election to John Quincy Adams, and Jackson not only came back, he had won the popular vote, he had won more electoral votes, but in a deadlock, they gave it to Quincy Adams. So Jackson comes back and smashes Quincy Adams 4 years later, and then when Clay runs 4 years after that, Jackson smashes him too.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting in this, Jackson then has to govern. So for example, his hatred for the Second Bank of the United States, how much of the economic woe, and we don't think about this, of the 19th century and all the way really up to the Great Depression, the boom and bust, terrible busts, you'd have unemployment at a third of the workforce, you'd have terrible depredations, was caused by Andrew Jackson's destruction of the Second Bank of the United States. And who felt the pain the most? Who was hurt the most? His supporters, poor people and their descendants who were – when you have a financial panic, when you have an economic catastrophe, who suffers? The people at the margins. You know, New York, I'm sure the people on Wall Street, a lot of bonuses were lost in the panic of 2008. And I'm sure a lot of bad people, you know, went bust and all of that. But where it really hurt were people, middle class people living on the margins who were counting on property values to retire on and were counting on 401ks to retire on. Those were the people who really got burned. Jackson tried to be true to the things that to the things that he promised and tried to be true to standing up against the elites. But as it turns out, sometimes the policies that they want and tariffs maybe turn out to be a good example of this with Trump. The tariffs may end up hurting a lot of the people who Trump wants to help and repay for their support. But he feels obliged to do it because that's the pact he made with his movement.
You were just saying that it's a good thing that many of these populists never actually had to govern. But
right.
The
you
irony
can say
is,
anything you want.
Yeah, but the irony is that Andrew Jackson and the other one who actually made it to the White House, Teddy Roosevelt, actually left quite popular, didn't they?
Well, you know, Roosevelt is very interesting. He went quite mad. I am in the minority of Americans. Who I am no fan of Teddy Roosevelt. He is so fascinating. You have this guy, he gets thrust into the presidency when an insane person kills President McKinley. And then the youngest president ever at 44, Roosevelt is thrust into the presidency. He, of course, as a total egomaniac, throws himself into the work like he had a mandate. And absolutely seizes the reins of power and has a very successful remainder of the term, is elected on his own right to a full term by an even bigger majority than McKinley had beaten William Jennings Bryan. And he goes on, and this is where he starts to really embrace the progressive populism, and this is where he's doing all this stuff. And he's going along gangbusters, and he's got big old William Howard Taft, his Secretary of War, lined up to be his successor, and he says, okay, now you're going to do everything I did, and here are the other things you're going to do after I'm gone, and I'll leave, and you can do that. So he goes to Africa, kills 1,000 water buffaloes, and finds that William Howard Taft, in fact, believes that he is his own person. And William Howard Taft was very conservative, and he did not favor trust busting, and he did not favor doing all of the really radical things that Roosevelt was talking about doing in those days, and wouldn't. And Roosevelt comes back, and if you talk about hubris, talk about misunderstanding a movement for yourself, Roosevelt comes back, makes his demands, and then goes and lays out when Barack Obama did basically his second term pitch, his second term economic pitch, he very intentionally went to the same town in Kansas where Teddy Roosevelt laid out his square deal for the 1912 election.
Right.
And Osawatomie, and goes out there and lays and Roosevelt lays out this thing that is a radical departure from even his own policies of before. He takes all the way to the convention in Chicago. He fights bitterly. There's violence at the state conventions. There's a serious threat of violence. Mobs are forming. Police are roaming the aisles of the convention in 1912 because it's gotten so ugly, the hatred between the Roosevelt faction and the Taft faction. Taft finally prevails. Roosevelt bolts, goes down across the town to Orchestra Hall and forms the Bull Moose Party that night. And they split the Republican vote and let Woodrow Wilson, the only Democrat, only two Democrats got elected president. Between Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, there were only two Democrats. That was Woodrow Wilson, and the other one was Grover Cleveland. And Wilson only got in, and we probably only got into the First World War, because of that fit of pique on the part of Roosevelt, who just couldn't stand that somebody else disagreed with him.
And of course, of all these men, Roosevelt was probably the least likely populist. He came from old money New York family, was a product of Boss Platt's political machine in New York.
Yep.
Where did his progressive populism come from?
Roosevelt was so sure that everybody else was stupid. His absolute conviction of his genius, of his, and this is as a product of a doting mother. He had been ill as a young man, had asthma, and this doting father and mother, and I recommend very highly David McCulloch's book Mornings on Horseback about the young Roosevelt. Fascinating, fascinating, and you see where it all comes from. So here is this. You could say spoiled brat, but here is this person who arrives in the world richer than Croesus and starts slashing his way through New York state politics or New York City politics and then state politics. And he is convinced that there is a correct way to do things. He and Ross Perot remind me a lot of each other. In their minds, there is a scientific, appropriate, correct way of doing things. There is their way and then there is the wrong way. And you're not just wrong. You're stupid. And he becomes so convinced of this. And we also have to remember at the time there was a strong belief, and it was strong in Wilson too, that the system that we had was antiquated and outdated. It didn't work anymore because what a republic, a liberal democracy and republican government are not suitable for the modern technological scientific era. They don't match up to these things. And now we have science. And people say that even now. Well, what the data says, this says, well, here's what we do know. Human beings are uniformly bad at predicting the future. And whenever anybody says, I have the right answer, and this is the way, going back and getting to listen to Ross Perot talk about how Japan and Germany were going to conquer us economically and rule the world, you're like snorting so hard. It's so funny to hear all these people in 1992, oh, yes, Japan is going, we will be the vassals of Japan. You're like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Perot was a surprising populist as well, because it's hard for me to imagine populist voters getting behind this sort of wonky IBM suit and tie guy with a bunch of charts and graphs.
Well, but the magic is there. The same magic is there in that he told you were getting screwed.
Yeah.
He said, you know why things are the way that they are? It's because these idiots and crooks are keeping you from your just desserts. And they're doing it to you. And basically, I think it was Dennis Miller in those days when I think he was still on Saturday Night Live. But he said that the best reason to vote for Perot was it would be like turning on the overhead light in the kitchen and watching all the cockroaches scurry under the refrigerator. That the idea of Perot as a smashing change, that you would come in, and this was really one of the best arguments that people made, that conservatives made on behalf of Donald Trump, where they said, yeah, well, he may be a wreck and he may be a this and he may be a that, but he will blow Washington to smithereens. He will shatter this consensus that is stifling us. And who knows what will be on the other side, but it can't be worse than this. And I think that's not too different from the energy that was behind Perot.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Chris Steyerwald when we come back in just a minute. Are you looking for expert coverage and analysis of the NFL this season? Look no further. NFL Podcasts has you covered. Interested in the latest news from around the league? The Around the NFL podcast crew has exclusive access to industry insiders and team personnel, allowing you, the listener, to feel in on all the action. Perhaps you'd like to hear more of your favorite analysts and players break things down on and off the field. Then don't miss out on the Dave Damashek football program, as Damashek and his guests operate on a strict no-jive policy. Only honest, unfiltered opinions allowed. Maybe you're more devoted than the average NFL fan? If so, be sure to catch the Move the Sticks podcast, hosted by former NFL scouts Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks. As the NFL preseason continues to heat up, make sure to follow along with NFL podcasts for bold predictions and insights into who will be the next big star. Subscribe now to Around the NFL, the Dave Damashek football program, and Move the Sticks on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. Hey folks, here's some advice for anyone who sends emails to their customers. You deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch. With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team, no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. Today's podcast was sponsored by Espresso Monster. That's right, now the guys behind Monster Energy have a delicious espresso drink for when you need an extra burst of energy but don't have time to wait in line at a coffee joint. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of smooth espresso and cream packaged in an 8.4-ounce can. It's just the right size and perfect for when you're on the go. Each can has 3 shots of espresso blended with European milk just the way the Italians do. At 150 to 160 milligrams of caffeine per can, it's sure to give you the energy you need to conquer the day. Espresso Monster has 2 delicious flavors to choose from, espresso and cream, and vanilla espresso. That one's my favorite. Man, it is tasty. Produced in Denmark and the Netherlands, Espresso Monster is made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend that's complete with taurine and B vitamins. In fact, I had one just before taping this podcast. You know how sluggish you feel around 1 or 2 o'clock after lunch? Me too. And when I'm tired, I can't get anything done. But I had a yummy vanilla espresso monster after lunch, and it gave me just the jolt I needed to power through the rest of my day. Try it for yourself. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, back to the podcast. Perot was sort of famous for peddling easy answers and, you know, telling people Washington already has all the solutions. They're just not using them, or, you know, a businessman can come in and fix everything so easily.
That's right. And like a lot in American business and a lot of these businessmen and a lot of what we hear from corporate America a lot is there's a correct answer out there. It's not just that there are a bunch of right answers or that there are a bunch of right things that we could do. It is that there is a empirically correct answer, and we can arrive at that empirically correct answer. We can have the charts. We can have the graphs to back it up, and then it will just be right. But, of course, a nation of 325 million people and 50 states spread out over 3,000 miles is not that way. Mm-hmm. And the tantalizing belief for Americans is always – that there's some correct setting where we can set the dials and then everything will just hum along in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think about what 9/11 did to us, the strong belief among Americans in 2000 or so was history's over, the Cold War's won, the future is just going to be about getting richer, and this is the way it's going to be. And then you get yanked out of that moment. You get pulled out of that moment. Oh, no. History is going on and the world is falling apart again, but in a new way. And tribalism and sectarianism, and we're gonna rend our garments, but in a different direction. The Americans have, especially Americans who are more affluent, have a strong desire to believe that there is a correct and optimal setting. What is correct and optimal in America is a system that allows that balance always between the elites and the populace, always between freedom and order, to keep pushing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, because it's in that back and forth that we can correct, then we overcorrect, and then we come back the other way, and we keep turning it, moving it, moving. It's like sailing a ship into the wind. The breeze changes, the water changes, the conditions change. You have to keep moving the sail. We have a system that lets us do that.
And oftentimes, indeed, it seems that the Constitution and populism are at odds.
Sure. Because I would promise you one thing, we would not need a Bill of Rights if the things that were in the Bill of Rights were popular.
Yeah.
There would be absolutely no need. We say we think free speech is good. We say that, but we had to write it down because, as it turns out, it's not really popular. Censorship is popular. Don't let him say that. He shouldn't be allowed to say that. Please stop him from saying that. It's popular with governments, too. Don't do that. Don't assemble over there. Don't talk about that. It'll be China. I very often, maybe not very often, I sometimes hear politicians yearn for the system they have in China. I hear politicians, I hear people like Tom Friedman from the New York Times columnist and author talk about it. And it's like, well, duh, of course it's simpler if you can control what people say, read, and do. Duh. But that's why we have a constitution, so that the rights of these individuals will not be infringed upon by the government. That Bill of Rights, that charter, our constitution, and the Bill of Rights taken together are to protect the hard and unpopular things. Mm-hmm. You don't need to write it down if it's going to be popular anyway.
Yeah, and I think you say that government operates best when it operates slowly, which of course makes me think of the Senate and the House and the whole teacup saucer analogy. you know, here in California, we're a good example of how poorly that kind of direct government works, because every election, you've got a dozen or more ballot initiatives, and some of them can get pretty kooky and maybe are reflections of the prevailing attitudes of the moment, but may not be smart policy long term.
Well, as I write about in the book, you say to somebody, would you like lower taxes or more spending? And they say, yes. No, you have to choose. No, I'll take both of those things. You know, this week, the federal government is back to a $1 trillion deficit. Because you say, well, do you want big defense spending? Uh-huh. Do you want tax cuts? Yeah. Do you want to not change entitlement programs? Yeah, leave those alone. Okay, well, now you're going to spend trillions of dollars more than you can afford. And it is an unavoidable truth. But if you – the point of our system of government is not to give the people what they want, but to make it possible so that the needs of the people and the will of the people can be heard and have an effect over the longer term inside the system. That's why we have a House versus a Senate. That's why we have an executive branch that is elected through the Electoral College. That's why we have a Supreme Court that is appointed for their lifetimes. Can I just say one other thing about that? If you want to know one of the reasons that our system is not working right now and the deficiencies and the frustrations we have, our legislative branch, our Congress, has weakened itself perniciously for the past 50 years. We don't have a Congress to speak of, not in the sense that we once did. They refused the power to make war. They refused the power to regulate. They have handed that off to administrative agencies in the executive branch. They just want to hold televised hearings, raise money, and run for reelection. And they don't want to. And they don't want to talk about things that are hard. They don't want to deal with abortion. Mm-hmm. They don't want to deal with Me Too stuff. They don't want to deal with don't leave it for the courts. Leave it for the executive branch. We don't want to do it. As a consequence, the demands of the people don't have any place to go, and we are ending up with more demagogic and more authoritarian, I guess that's what I'd have. Maybe that's not the right word, but you have seen the trend. Bush, Obama, and Trump, more executive power. Mm-hmm. Wield to act. Somebody's got to act. As George W. Bush said, when people are hurting, government's got to move. And by that, he meant he's going to move. And Obama, yeah. I have a pen, I have a phone. And Trump, basically, you know, change the rules of the Senate so that I can pass whatever I want whenever I want it. And if you won't do that, I'll do it by legislative fiat, because we're just going to do it and smash through all these things. That is, when we think about what kills a republic and when we think about what kills the freedom of the people, nothing is worse than when Huey Long said, wouldn't it be, I'm going to butcher this quote, but wouldn't it be something like a dictatorship if the will of the people were perfectly represented at all times? He was accused of being a dictator, and he said, oh, yeah? Well, wouldn't it be like a dictatorship if the will of the people was met all of the time? Of course I'd be like a dictator, because I'm going to give the people what they want every time. I'm going to say, what do you – and Ross Perot had the idea of televised town halls where people could push a button to vote on what to do, direct democracy, and say – okay, I'm not a dictator, because the people have all 51% of the people have agreed that we are going to confiscate the property of 20% of the people, or 51% of the people have agreed that we are going to reinstitute Jim Crow laws, or 51% of the people have agreed on whatever. The tyranny of the majority is the enemy of freedom. populism is good when it is breaking up the ice pack that surrounds Washington and New York and L.A. now, too, but and Silicon Valley. But these centers of power where the where people and wealth accumulate in these large numbers, it is good that there is a threat against them. And it is good that there is a check on their power. When it crosses over into the tyranny of the majority and pure majoritarianism, then it's just tyranny by another name.
Huey Long, you know, he was one of the rare politicians who actually got pretty far by embracing the label of a socialist, an authoritarian, and a radical. If it hadn't been for the Great Depression, do you think that he would have had such a political ascent?
Well, Louisiana was still he would have at least gotten to the Senate. He could have gotten to the Senate from Louisiana because Louisiana was so poor and so crooked back in those days that the depression or no depression, the good people of Winfield and Wynn Parish, Louisiana, they were going to be poor no matter what. But I do think you're quite right. 1935 was a very low watermark for this country, and ideas about fascism. Fascism was not a dirty word. We know that the American Nazi Party, for example, on the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, claimed a couple hundred thousand members. Huey Long claimed 7 million members in Share Our Wealth societies across the country. Father Coughlin preached anti-Semitic, vicious, nasty stuff on the radio and had millions of listeners and millions of followers, because when times are hard and people are frightened, They are willing to listen to authoritarians in ways that they are not under normal circumstances, because they say, I want protection, and I want, even if he's a bad guy, I want him to be a bad guy for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, at a time when we're talking about wanting to drain the swamp, here you have a guy who was a product of the swamp, both metaphorically and literally, growing up in Louisiana. And this guy was so crooked that he actually embraced the nickname Kingfish, and he had literally been a snake oil salesman before going into politics. Yet the voters loved him, you know, and a good portion of national Democrats were totally at peace with just following a con man. How did his supporters rationalize his sliminess?
Well, think about this. One of his main products that he sold when he was a young man, he was starting out, sold door to door, was called Wine of Cardooey. And Wine of Cardooey was supposed to be to cure the derangements of women at a certain time of the month, and to address the questions of a fallen womb and all of this stuff. And they sold it that way. Now, what it really was 40 proof wine. It was hooch, and it had some thistles and bark and, you know, whatever in it. But it was hooch in a dry county in the days of Prohibition. But this was a legal way that you could sell booze. How many of the women who bought Huey Long's Wine of Cardooey from the Chattanooga Patent Medicine Company, how many of them who bought it knew exactly what this was? That they knew that this was a socially acceptable, legal way for them to buy fortified wine and keep it at home. And their husbands sure weren't going to say anything about it, lest their derangements not be cured anymore. So for the when you're dealing with a con man, when you're dealing with a huckster, you know, how many of Donald Trump's supporters know that some of the stuff he says just isn't true?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them know it's not true, and they laugh and don't care? And it doesn't bother them because he's goring somebody else's ox. When Donald Trump says, this is the first time in 100 years that GDP has been higher than unemployment. Well, that's not true, but they probably don't care because he's their guy. He's doing it for them. And they just laugh and say, oh, Trump, he's crazy. When Trump tweets, when Trump does the stuff that swing voters or persuadable voters get very uncomfortable with, when his personal actions, behavior, and attitude and sometimes distant relationship with the truth upsets those voters, the people who feel that he's on their side and doing it for him, they say, yeah, well, whatever, shut up. And I think that for a lot, I'm sure there were people who were absolutely conned by Huey Long. I'm sure there were people who absolutely thought that he was just a sweet angel of a man who was out there fighting hard to try to help the little folks. But I also suspect that there were many of them, if not most of them, who instead said, all politicians are dirtbags. I got a dirtbag here who at least punches the right direction.
You rarely hear a populist politician utter the words, you can't have what you want, or it's not within my power. Is it fair to say that populists generally aren't very good at tough love?
They are not, because if we believe that the people are to rule, so what a republic, our system of government says not that the people rule, but that all rightful power descends from the public, right? Mm-hmm. This is we are in a trusteeship with our government, that we have empowered the government and it is it acts as our proxy. The power is derived from the will of the people, but the decisions do not derive from the will of the people. But if you say whatever the people want, the people should rule, you can't then say, except for on that. Except for there. When I think about, you know, in the conclusion of the book, I talk about the election of 1864 and Abraham Lincoln and, you know, the miracle of Abraham Lincoln. And at a time where if we were ever going to have a true out and out demagogue and an authoritarian, Abraham Lincoln was set for it perfectly. He had everything he needed. But they called that election in 1864. And remarkably, amazingly, Lincoln did not ever flinch from the work. He did not say, and if you act now, we'll end the war next week and no one else will have to die and slavery will be abolished anyway, unless you don't want it to be, and then it's fine and see you later. He said, we have this hard work to do. We have this bad hard work that we have to do and we mean to finish it. And, you know, if you read his second inaugural and you think about what he was saying, what he was talking about, the brutal work of that war almost concluded and a promise to keep doing it if necessary. And then even more astonishingly to say, but we are going to forgive the rebels. We are going to forgive our countrymen who in treason, in revolt, we're going to forgive them. We're going to bind up our wounds and we're going to be one country again. None of that should have been popular. But great leaders don't just ride populist waves. They enlarge the human spirit. They enlarge the human mind. They live up to the standards of men like Lincoln, of people like George Washington, and other leaders who didn't just say, I'll give you whatever you want if you just put me in charge. What they say is, there's a right place to go, and I want you to come there with me.
Well, this may be a somewhat strange segue, but I might point out that of these seven populist politicians, better than half of them were victims of assassinations or attempted assassinations. What does that tell us about populism in America?
Well, when you stir up these passions, right, when you bring these things out, if you are, you know, Caesar and Brutus, right? Mm-hmm. It's an old story. When you stir these things up, if you're a real demagogue, right? And Long was a by God, the realest of them all. If you're a real demagogue and you are making dishonest exploitations of emotion, if you are dividing people for your own benefit, if you are doing those things, if that's what you're doing, the maelstrom does not leave you alone. You are on those seas. And I don't know that, let's see. Assassinated were they tried to kill TR.
Right.
An assassin paralyzed Wallace.
Yeah.
They killed Huey Long.
And Jackson.
Anybody else? And Jackson. They tried to kill Jackson too. Well, but I got to say, until the very modern era where the Secret Service, basically the post 1963 era, well, actually after Squeaky Frome in 1975, the Secret Service deals with the situations and they understand now about shutting down access and protective bubbles and making sure that everybody's wanted. The amount of security and the way that they protect the president now is very different than the way it used to be. But doing the math, and we could figure it out pretty quickly. I don't think anybody tried to kill Jimmy Carter, but other than that, everybody got a try. So if you get if you got elected president, everybody prior to George W. Bush, they got shot at, or somebody tried to stab him or run him over with a car or a carriage or something.
Yeah, and in the case of Jackson, you might have wanted a protective bubble to protect the assassin.
And he was old, too. When the guy came after him and his pistol jammed, man, if you come to kill Andy Jackson, I don't care if he's 70 years old or not, you better get the job done. Because picture that, the president of the United States, his cane out, his walking stick out, bludgeoning in the head his would-be assassin. Now, That is street cred.
And real quickly before we go, you say that the populist leaders of today shouldn't be asking who will protect the white men in America, but who will be the Andrew Jackson of Hispanic America.
Well, and I don't know that that's a question for Republicans so much as it is us as observers of the news, as analysts. You know, the next wave of populist energy is probably going to look a lot more like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez than Donald Trump. And Andrew Jackson, the miracle, the thing about Andrew Jackson is he was the product of an immigrant wave. His parents were immigrants, penniless immigrants. His father was probably died a squatter. We don't know for sure, but he probably died squatting on land that wasn't his. And Andrew Jackson became the first governor of Florida, the first senator from Tennessee, won the Battle of New Orleans, became president of the United States, built a massive fortune, did all of those things. For Hispanic Americans now, which represent the most recent huge wave of immigration, basically mid-80s to 2010, millions of Americans, among them and among their children and grandchildren, who will rise? Who will rise and be the leader of a populist revolt on their behalf? Because it's out there, and we would be wise to be watching.
Yeah. Again, Chris's book is called Every Man a King, A Short, Colorful History of American Populists. I really enjoyed it. Chris Steirwalt. Thanks for joining me.
You're very kind and generous. I really appreciate this time.
Thanks again to Chris Steirwalt for coming on the podcast. Get his book, Every Man a King, A Short, Colorful History of American Populists on Amazon, Audible, or in bookstores. Subscribe to his podcast, Perino and Steirwalt, I'll Tell You What, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. And follow him on Twitter at Chris Steirwalt. You deserve a better email marketing platform, and unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch. Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more, so you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. Today's podcast was brought to you by Espresso Monster. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream. I wouldn't even be recording this podcast right now if I hadn't had a vanilla espresso monster after lunch today. It's delicious, and it was just the jolt I needed. Try for yourself, folks. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.